You've recently produced a report focusing on human rights and weapons, and I'm wondering if you can tell us about that report.
This is a report that we've done now for 3 years, and it's actually meant to be a very simple, easy to understand report. We take about four countries from each region of the world, and we choose them by A, the amount of weapons that they've received from the United States in the past year or bought from the U.S., and B, the types of human rights abuses that occur in those countries. And it changes from year to year which countries we use, but the idea is to combine data from the State Department on human rights and data from the State Department on U.S. arms sales and combine them. Because the State Department not only does this report on human rights, but they also license weapons for sale to these particular countries. And one of the criteria in licensing arms exports is human rights. So clearly, the State Department should know what the human rights abuses are in these particular countries. So what we would try to do is bring this together to show people that the State Department isn't really paying that much attention to human rights when it licenses a lot of these weapon sales. So, for instance, last year we looked at Chad, Colombia, Ecuador, Ghana, Haiti, Israel, Kenya, Malaysia, the Philippines, Saudi Arabia, Senegal, Singapore, Thailand, Turkey, the United Arab Emirates, and Venezuela. They all have, like Singapore, for instance, doesn't have a lot of overt human rights in terms of extrajudicial killings, but it's such a repressive society in terms of civil rights that it's certainly up there among the top countries of places that the people really are repressed. Turkey, Colombia are obviously more notorious for the straight-out killings and torturing of people. Israel not only doesn't give equal rights to Palestinians, but police are allowed to use torture. The military does a lot of what we see now. There's a lot of concern about some of the overt military tactics that Israel uses against the Palestinians. So we detail some of the human rights abuses in these countries, and then we also compare that not only to the amount of weapons that these countries buy or receive, but also what types of weapons, focusing on small arms.
Give us some feel for the total amount, let's say, of small arms that are being shipped out.
Small arms, dollar value-wise, never make a huge percentage of total U.S. arms sales because they're cheaper. Planes and tanks and ships, that's where the big money is at, missiles, so on and so forth. So small arms, it's not a vast number, but let's look at Colombia, for instance. Now, foreign military sales, that's Pentagon sales, last year, this is 99, fiscal 99, $4.5 million. The delivery value, though, the actual number of arms sales that were delivered to Colombia was about $19 million. The direct commercial sale licenses, this is State Department licensing weapons, export licenses for corporations that allow them to go talk to a particular country about a particular weapon sale. It's kind of confusing, but what the State Department does is it, say you're Lockheed Martin, go to the State Department, say, I want to talk to Chile about buying F-16s. This is how many F-16s, this is about what the price is going to be. It's okay with the State Department. They issue a license to Lockheed that allows them to actually go talk to Chile about this potential deal. The State Department doesn't really follow up on it after that. So we don't really know whether a lot of these sales end up in contracts or not. So that's how the State Department works its particular arms sales branch. To Colombia, in fiscal 99, there was $66.4 million worth of weapons licensed to Colombia. The majority of that is small arms. A lot of these countries also get what's called international military education training. And this is where they actually send soldiers to the United States to be trained by our military. The School of America is a controversial school in Fort Benning, I believe, that people constantly complain about. The school that trained Manuel Noriega and the soldiers that killed the Jesuit priests in El Salvador and the nuns there, they were trained at the School of America. That's an IMET program. The International Military Education Training paid for those Salvadorian soldiers to come up to the United States. They paid for Manuel Noriega. All those notorious human rights abusers in Latin America have been trained through IMET. Not a huge amount of money, but quite a few soldiers, about $593,000 worth of training, and that probably trains about 500 students. If you look at the types of small arms, we're talking about. Again, Colombia is a great example because of the civil war down there. It's a very complicated situation. But the U.S. is getting more and more involved in the training of Colombian military and police, not just in counter-narcotics training, but also counterinsurgency training. We licensed about $66.4 million worth of weapons to Colombia. About 214,000 of that are pistols and revolvers. 54,000 is riot-controlled chemicals. They got about 24,000 in night vision goggles, 46 machine guns, 111 assault rifles, ammunition, over $1 million in equipment and training. Again, doesn't sound like a lot of money, but the impact that small arms have is astounding. Recently, there was a conference in Geneva on small arms. This got a lot of press because the Bush administration went in there and said, okay, we are not going to sign any kind of document, which was not legally binding, by the way, not going to sign any kind of international document coming out of this convention that A, doesn't allow countries to sell to non-state actors, and B, we're not going to sign it if there's any language in there that attempts to restrict civilian possession of weapons. The international community recognizes that this is a problem with small arms. Let's say the United States sells some small arms to what appears to be a relatively stable country. Well, there's no guarantee that those small arms stay in the hands of the military or the police. They can often be transferred to non-state actors or other countries that we might find offensive or we might not want to sell weapons to. In the case of Colombia, a lot of these weapons that we sell to the military and to the police end up in the hands of the right-wing paramilitary death squads down there. These right-wing groups commit the vast majority of human rights abuses in Colombia. They also run drugs, which is the exact stated purpose of why we're sending weapons to Colombia in the first place, is to fight the leftist insurgents who make money from drugs. But our small arms often end up in the hands of these right-wing death squads. There's very little way you can track a small arm once you deliver it to a country. Once you send it there, it's almost impossible to track it. And that's the problem with small arms, is they get transferred all over the place. Africa is a prime example of weapons that have been in the continent for 20 years are still being used in places like Sierra Leone or the Congo. So there's an international attempt to kind of restrict the small arms trade. And the Bush administration kind of short-circuited that whole attempt last month in Geneva when they put such strict criteria on the language that the convention was able to come up with. So this is a concern. I know this is a long-winded answer, but it's cases like Colombia where, you know, we're selling them machine guns and pistols and revolvers and ammunition that could easily get into the hands of people we don't want it to get into.
Now, your report focuses on several countries from each region. Perhaps talk about some of the other countries and or regions that you looked at and what kind of patterns are emerging in all these countries.
Latin America, you know, I already mentioned Colombia. We also detailed Haiti, Venezuela, and Ecuador. The pattern that we see emerging now since the Chilean purchase of 10 F-16s to the United States earlier this year, this region had not been buying sophisticated weaponry for nearly 20 years. It's the least militarized region in the world, actually. But with the Chilean purchase of these 10 jets, that was kind of the signal for countries in the region to start upgrading a lot of their military. So we're going to see Brazil is interested in buying new jet aircraft now. Argentina is probably a few years behind, though they have some economic problems. Peru's even mentioned that they may have to buy more MiGs in order to counteract Chile's F-16 purchase. So there's a lot of concern about an arms race in that area. But the small arms is going to continue. That's what the majority of the countries are interested in. That's what they're going to buy. One of our concerns is because crime is so rampant in certain Latin American countries, Honduras, for instance, the amount of weapons that the United States is licensing or delivering to a place like Honduras far exceeds what their military or police forces need. Since these are commercial sales, essentially what's happening is we are selling weapons, or we're licensing weapons, I should say, to Honduras that civilians are going to purchase. And a lot of them are kind of these security forces, private security firms, of which there's virtually no control. There's a lot of vigilante-type justice in Honduras, often done at the hands of these private security firms. Well, it's very likely that a lot of these weapons that we're licensing to Honduras are in fact being used for this purpose. I mean, just last year, for instance, the size of the Honduran military is about 8,300. They have about 6,000 police. Now, if you look at the number of pistols and revolvers licensed to Honduras just last year, it was 5,000. The year before that, it was 5,800. So in a simple two-year period, we licensed more small arms to Honduras than their entire military. Plus, military, most of them don't carry pistols and revolvers. They don't carry sidearms. They carry rifles. So where is this 11,000 pistols going? It's not going to the military. It's going to somebody else. And that's far more than what the police forces are. So chances are they're going to these private security firms. So that's one of our concerns in the area. El Salvador, again, places like Colombia. These are countries where there's a rise in the security firms. Costa Rica, which doesn't even have a military, has gotten a vast amount of these small arms, pistols and revolvers, in the last couple of years. Just last year, they got over 2,000 rifles. This is a country that doesn't have a military. They were licensed 6,000 pistols. Where's that all going? Chances are it's going to some of these private security firms and vigilante groups. That's one of the issues that we're going to be focusing on the next few years.
Would it be fair to say, then, that in most of these situations, for certainly for small arms sales, that it's not the State Department that is saying, we think this region is fairly weak in arms, specifically these countries, and then they go to the manufacturing companies here in the U.S. and say, we think this area could be good for sales? It sounds like it's exactly the opposite, where it's these U.S. companies that are approaching...
pushing it.
Yeah, that
yeah,
are pushing
no,
it. And it's
yeah.
got nothing to do with, you know, our policies in the region.
This is something I don't think a lot of people really understand. There's still this notion that the companies are kind of beholden to the government, and that arms sales are done from a purely political expediency process. In other words, what's our political agenda in this particular region, and where do arms sales fit into that? That's really not how it works anymore. Once the Cold War ended, and the defense industry here downsized because the United States quit buying a lot of new military weaponry, the companies decided to export rather than convert to civilian production. They decided to export a lot of their weapons. So the United States took a huge lead in the arms trade, and a report that was published this year, actually last month, by the Congressional Research Service is called the Grimmett Report. The U.S., according to the data in that report, now has about 50% of the world's arms market and about two-thirds of the arms market to the developing world. That doesn't include these direct commercial sales that I've been mentioning, except for one, and that was the sale of F-16s to the UAE, which everybody knows went through. So the $55 billion worth of arms export licenses issued by the State Department last year, other than about $6.5 billion of it, which we know the UAE got, we don't know how many of those licenses ended up in sales. So we're talking about $48 billion worth of licenses that are essentially unaccounted for. Do we get $20 billion worth of sales out of that? 10, 5, 30? Nobody knows. Even if it's, say, you know, $7 or $8 billion, which isn't a very large percentage, that's going to make the U.S. control of the arms market probably around 70%. It's huge. The U.S. dominates the arms market in all areas. Small arms, big arms, to developing nations, to developed nations, you name it. Our companies are really pushing sales, exports, as a way for them to make profit. For instance, I know I've talked a lot about Latin America, but in 1997, at the bequest in the lobbying of the defense industry, particularly Lockheed Martin, President Clinton lifted the nearly 20-year ban on high-tech weapon sales that the U.S. had imposed on Latin America. Why did Clinton do this? Because Chile had started the negotiating process for advanced jet fighters, and Lockheed Martin wanted to get a piece of the action. So they lobbied President Clinton to lift the arms sales ban. Now, this is something that politically, there's no reason for the United States to arm Latin America. There's no regional conflicts to speak of. These countries are poor. They're fledgling democracies. They have to boost their economies and improve things like education and healthcare and infrastructure. And instead, if you get them involved in a high-tech arms race, they're going to be spending that money on weapons. There is no need for the United States to lift that ban, but President Clinton did it because of the lobbying of the defense industry. So the government is essentially being led around right now by the dollar signs in the defense company's eyes.
So the flip side of that, since there's no follow-up by the State Department on whether these contracts then went through, would it be reasonable to assume then that for some of them, instead of it actually being less than the dollar amount estimated by the company, that it could actually be more than the...
That often does happen, but they don't know that until a few years later. And the State Department often does go back and reassess a particular license, and the company will say, well, actually, you know, it wasn't $10 million, it was worth $12 million. So yes, some of those values, and it's generally the case, they end up being worth more a couple years later when they actually do sign the agreement or get into the negotiations. The dollar value will change. Again, it's very hard to track this kind of stuff. You brought up a good point about the companies. There's another kind of disconcerting aspect about this. I brought up the UAE. The UAE bought last year $6.5 billion worth of F-16s, for ADF-16s, from the U.S., and about $1.3 billion worth of weaponry for those F-16s. So it's about a $7.8 billion deal total. The F-16s that the UAE is purchasing are better than the F-16s currently in the U.S. arsenal, and will be better than the F-16s in the U.S. arsenal when the UAE's F-16s are delivered in 2004. The radar system and the avionics system that's going to be included on the UAE's planes is currently in development. We haven't even built it yet. So when it comes off the production line, it will be the best radar and avionics system for attack jets in the world. The UAE is actually paying for the R&D cost of this, not the United States. The U.S. isn't even interested in purchasing this stuff. This was something that Northrop Grumman, who builds this radar and avionics system, this is something that they were tooling around with anyway. And they saw an opportunity with the UAE to get a sale for this. So they pushed it, the Air Force pushed it. So all this R&D money, it's about $3 billion worth, is being paid for by the UAE. So now our defense companies aren't even pursuing research and development that the United States government wants. They're pursuing R&D that other countries want in expectation of an export sale. That, I think, is something that people really ought to be concerned about. Rather than pursuing what the U.S. government might have interest in, our companies are now beholden to the interest of other countries. And that's a concern. And it's also a concern that we're exporting weaponry that's better than our own. Super Hornet, for instance, the new version of the FA-18. We've just started building this about 2 years. We've been in low-rate initial production, and the State Department and the Pentagon cleared that plane for export. So now other countries can buy a plane that's going to be as good as stuff that we're building right now. So we're in an arms race with ourselves. If we export this stuff that's as good or better than our own, as soon as we get the new equipment, we're going to have to turn around and build something else. But the only way it's cost-effective, at least according to the companies, is if they can export it. So we're in this vicious cycle where we have to export as soon as we build stuff. And as soon as we build stuff, the rationale is we need a new equipment to be better than the stuff we've exported, but we're going to export that new thing as soon as we build it. And there doesn't seem to be a way out of this vicious cycle anytime soon. And that, again, is a different angle to the fact of this kind of changing arms exports from a political process into an economic issue. That change, which has occurred after the, particularly during the Gulf War, after the Cold War and during the Gulf War, that's when this change took place, and one of the nasty side effects is it gets us into an arms race with ourselves.
So is there any other government body beyond the State Department that's even attempting to regulate any of this?
Well, the Pentagon has its own arms sales branch. The Pentagon at least knows when they make a sale. because they are essentially acting as the corporation, so they know when it happens, when the sale occurs or if it doesn't occur. But the Pentagon, they have slightly stricter controls, but in general, again, they try to export as much as possible. They have more of a mind's eye towards U.S. security than the State Department, because again, the State Department doesn't even know if some of these sales go through. They're just saying, oh, it's okay if you talk to this country about this stuff, and if you come to agreement, that's great. The Pentagon is a little more concerned because they're the ones that are going to have to go fight the wars in these other parts of the world where the U.S. may have armed those countries. I mean, we did it in Haiti, in Iraq, Panama, Somalia. We armed every single one of those countries to some degree or another. And we ended up in conflicts with those countries. So this is a situation where arms sales have come back, boomeranged against us. The Pentagon has a little more of an eye towards that, so they're a little better. But the general rule of thumb is try to streamline exports as much as possible, get rid of the controls, make it go as fast as possible, and export with an eye towards the health of the U.S. defense industry rather than U.S. national security.
So has there been any effort since you've been working on these issues from any group to curb the sales of arms worldwide?
Not in the United States. Great Britain, when Tony Blair took office, one of the first things they did was institute a so-called ethical policy on the arms trade. So Great Britain has stopped some arms sales from going through to certain countries, but certainly not in a dramatic fashion. There's been some attempt at the UN. Obviously, I mentioned the Small Arms Conference recently. There's been attempts to curb small arms sales. There was legislation introduced, what's called a Code of Conduct on Arms Transfers. This was also introduced in the United States and in the European Union. This Code of Conduct would restrict arms sales to unelected governments and human rights abusers. Didn't go anywhere in the UN. It actually passed in the European Union, but it was very much watered down. The transparency provisions are not very good, which is one of its main failings, and it also wasn't legally binding, but at least it was a start. The United States almost got it passed a few years ago, but it has since lost a lot of steam. But this was, again, legislation that was introduced in the House by Cynthia McKinney, representative from Georgia, and pushed by a lot of organizations like the Council for a Livable World. But it's essentially kind of got undercut, watered down, and now we don't have anything really cooking right now to tighten the restrictions on the U.S. arms trade. So, yeah, right now, small arms looks like the best opportunity to get something. As far as large items like jet planes, attack jets, tanks, missile systems, I don't think we're going to have any luck with that because there's just too much money involved, and it's very hard to fight the corporations. Small arms, though, there's less money involved, and they're a lot more damaging in the civil war conflicts that you see in places like Africa in particular. So I think there's hope there, but with the Bush administration poo-pooing everyone's efforts there last month, it's going to be difficult to get anything past the Bush administration, particularly when they're being so unilateralist in their demands that it's going to be difficult. So it looks like it's going to be a tough 4 years.
So has there, beyond people like Representative Cynthia McKinney, has there been any other people standing up, showing some spine within the Congress or the Senate?
Not recently, no. There has been, there's been some good progress this year on a bill kind of restricting purchasing or tightening the criteria for what diamonds are available to be sold, in concern that a lot of the diamonds sold on the world market actually go to fund rebel groups in Africa, that these groups are in fact selling these diamonds. So there's legislative efforts underway in both UN, US, EU to kind of increase the scrutiny that diamonds get to make sure that they come from legitimate sources. So that will actually, I think, do a lot to decrease the amount of money some of these groups have to buy weapons, some of these rebel groups in Africa, which is the main problem, is in Africa, obviously, because that's where most of the diamonds are mined. So there's both a bill in the House and the Senate that looks to be moving along quite nicely. But outside of that, now, like, there's just no legislative vehicles for people to get excited about. So no one's going to stick their neck out for something, you know, when there's no legislation for it. It's just not the way things are going right now. The progress we have is really kind of inside baseball, inside the beltway kind of stuff, where you might have people fight to keep tight restrictions on the munitions list, or fight to maintain congressional scrutiny of arms sales to NATO countries. There's a lot of effort to try to streamline the defense export process to make it easier to export weapons. So there's a lot of people kind of fighting behind the scenes to maintain a lot of these restrictions, not just let it all go to the wind there. But that's not the kind of stuff you're ever going to hear about or read about in the news, because it's very minor, detail-type-oriented stuff. But as far as, like, really significant legislation like Code of Conduct on Arms Transfers, no, there's nothing.
Well, you're not painting a very inspiring picture here.
Well, I think small arms is something where, you know, if the American public was to write their congressperson or senator or, you know, even the administration and say, look, we want something done about small arms, there's a lot of good evidence that small arms wreak havoc around the world. The recent 655 report, again, as I said, $55 billion worth of exports. A large portion of those licenses are small arms. You've got countries that we license weapons to buy a certain amount of what, you know, we sell stuff to, say, Italy. Well, Italy will often then sell it to Bulgaria. Bulgaria sells to everybody. So a lot of these weapons end up on the black market, but the initial sale is government to government, what we consider an above board sale. We really have to restrict the sale of these small arms. The vast majority of the world's conflicts are fought with rifles and pistols and grenades and mortars, and that's what's doing the damage. These weapons are easy to transfer around. You can't track this stuff. We have to have some kind of controls on this. And this is what's made the Bush administration's position at Geneva Conference on Small Arms so disheartening. It's because rather than go to the conference and say, okay, look, we have some concerns about some of the provisions, but we understand where everybody's coming from, and we realize something has to be done about it, so let's try to work on, you know, language that will be a good compromise deal between us. They came in and said, if there's anything restricting sales to non-state actors, we're not going to go for it. Rather than say, try to define what a non-state actor is in order to allow U.S. sales of weapons to places like Taiwan, instead of coming in and saying, we are not going to allow any language that restricts civilian possession of weapons, why not go in, and again, this is all for a legally non-binding document, why not go in and negotiate with these people, these other countries, to come up with suggestions for civilian restriction of arms that are similar or mirror that in the United States. We have controls over civilian possession of weapons, and that's all that some of these other countries were asking, is that we try to get some kind of norm for what civilians can own. But instead of working with these countries, the Bush administration comes in and says it's, you know, our way or the highway. Well, that's not going to allow for any progress to be made on this issue. And I think the American public really could force the Bush administration to change its tone on this. But they have to get active, and they have to write the administration and their congresspeople and let them know how they feel about this stuff. Again, I think there's a lot of momentum internationally on this issue. It's just a matter of the United States getting on board.